Welcome to the West Highland Way Race Podcast. I'm John Kinnaston and this is episode 30. I'd like to wish you a happy 2013, and particularly if you're new to ultra running and the West Highland Way Race in 2013 will be your first one, then a very special happy new year to you. And I hope that your training's gone well over Christmas time and New Year. I know a number of people ran the Markathon and did really well to complete that, running every day in December. And then for a lot of folks, just trying to build up their training for the various ultra races that they're hoping to do in 2013. The West Highland Way Race now is just over 5 months away. So for lots of us, we're starting to think more about it and start to plan our long runs and get ourselves in good shape for the race. So I thought I'd do some more podcasts this year. Not quite sure it'll be weekly, maybe fortnightly or every 3 weeks or so. But basically, there'll be a number over the next few months that hopefully will give you some ideas and some thoughts about your training and just some inspiration to keep those miles going and get yourself there. A number of us have joined in our West Highland Way Race team on Jantastic, which is a part of the Marathon Talk podcast. And I think we've got 26 in our team, and that we're just seeking to encourage each other to run and to set a number of goals over these next few months. Also, another good place for inspiration is the Facebook. There's a really interesting post that's gone on from Stan Bland at the moment, and he's basically asking the question about fat fit question mark, and he says, "What's your view? Which is it, carbs or fats that are best to fuel you? I've been looking at some research, and there seems to be some decent evidence to suggest that we should be loading up on fats and reducing the carbs. From an ultra perspective, after adapting enables access to a fuel tank of 20,000 cals rather than 2,000 cals. Already there's been over 50 comments on that, some really interesting stuff and some articles to read. So if you're someone who wants to think about your fueling for the race, then that's a really good one. And do keep your eye on the Facebook page, because it seems to be used quite a bit for comments, both more light-hearted ones, but also some serious comments and serious questions about what's going on. Sadly, our West Highland Way forum seems to be dying a little bit, but some people still use that, so that's worth having a look as well. But the Facebook page does seem to be the one where most people seem to be posting now. On this podcast, I've got four items. The first one is I've read out some profiles. A couple of weeks ago, I sent an email around to everyone who has a place in the West Highland Way race asking for a photograph and just a short profile about themselves, why they want to do the race, their background and their hopes for the race. And I've had well over 50 in already. It's quite a few to go still, but a good number have come in. And I've just read out five just to give you a little bit of a flavour of what's going on and there's comments that people are making on that. And then after that, my blog post of the week is a blog from Jez Bragg. Jez is currently running in New Zealand, and so I've read out one of his blog posts again to give you a flavour of what he's up to at the moment. And then the next item is an interview with David McClure. David has entered the West Highland Way Race for the first time this year, and like last year when I followed Caroline and Colin as first timers, even though it was Caroline's second race, but first time she's finished. And I thought it'd be interesting again to do that. And so David's very kindly offered to be interviewed every few weeks, and we'll follow his progress in the training. I am looking for one other person who would maybe like to do that as well. So if this is your first West Highland Way race and you'd like to be interviewed every now and again, then do get in touch with me. So that's well worth listening to. We did that over David's iPad on Skype, and it was a little bit patchy at times, but hopefully you'd be able to hear most of it and most of what he had to say. And then the main item for this podcast is Andy Cole. Anyone who knows Andy, either by person or reading his blog, will know that Andy really thinks carefully as an engineer background, retired now, He really analyzes things really well. And I love reading what Andy has to write about races and about his thoughts on training and various things. And I asked him would he contribute again, and he's done a really good little piece on footwear and a little bit of background about his own running, but then talks about what he's found about the best footwear for him. And there's some really good principles there. It's one of the questions that lots of people ask: what's the best footwear for the West Harlem Way? And it does come down to individual choice, but Andy's put some good principles down there which I think all of us would find really helpful. So that's our podcast for this week, and I hope you enjoy it, whether you're out running or relaxing somewhere. I hope that there's some things on this podcast that will encourage and help you in your own training. One of the great things about the West Harlem Way race is the friends that you meet and fellow competitors. And when I took over the website last year, I thought it'd be a fun idea to resurrect something that Dario did before, which was to put some photos on, and I thought I'd add and ask people to write a little profile about themselves. And last year it went pretty well, and it was good to just to get a feel of who was running the race. And so again, for this year, for the 2013 race, I thought I'd do the same again, and already I've got well over 50 people that have sent in their profiles and their pictures, and they're all on the westharlemwayrace.org website. So just go to the homepage and then 2013 start, and there's a list there of everyone's name, which category they're in, how many West Harlem Way races they've done in the past, their PB and their year of PB, and then the final column says profile. And as a yes, if that people have sent me in their profiles. And one of the things I've really enjoyed over the last couple of weeks as they've been coming in is just reading different people's ideas and thoughts and reasons why they wanted to enter the race. And so I thought I'd just read a few of them out just to give you a bit of a flavour of why people are entering and what their hopes for the race are. The first one I've picked out, I've just picked out five almost at random. I could have picked any of them, but I thought I'd just pick these as a bit of a flavour of people's thoughts. So the first one is Keith Ainsley, and he says, I'm a 49-year-old latecomer to running. Did my first 10K about 6 years ago and my first marathon in 2011. I'm now completely addicted to running. Since I'm unlikely to get a lot faster at my age, I've decided I should try going further, and ran my first three ultras last year. I prefer races that have a bit of character or are unusual, and the West Harlem Way race certainly fits that bill. I love the friendship, banter and family feel that surrounds Scottish ultra races, and I love the fact that most normal people can't get their head round running a marathon and find a 95 mile race distance completely incomprehensible. I'm rubbish when I miss out on sleep, so I suppose my objective for the race is not to be running through two nights, to enjoy the experience and to make as many new friends as I can throughout the journey to the start at Mulgai and beyond. And Keith has a blog, keithainsley.blogspot.co.uk. The second one I've picked out is Norma Bone, and Norma says, when I completed the fling this year, others convinced me to have a go at the West Harlem Way race. Great, says me. I'll look forward to doing that when I retire. No, you won't, was the chorus. Do it now. You might not be able to in a couple of years. So with 15 marathons over 10 years, 3 ultras in 2011 and 7 in 2012 under my belt, and a lot of encouragement from the West Harlem Way family, as well as my own family and friends, I'm going to give it a go. Starting with ultras so late in life, I'm learning so much about my body and brain. I'm fascinated as to what my limits are. 2012 has seen me running more miles than I ever thought could ever have thought, near enough the mileage of 2 previous years. Amazingly, my running has improved my ability to work more hours, and that in turn has improved my stamina to run more. I'm so determined to receive that goblet. It's okay, Ian. I'll try to complete in less than 34 hours, 59 minutes, 59 seconds. I have a fantastic crew lined up and a great family and my friends putting up with me going on and on and on about this challenge. There are plenty of training runs going round in my brain, and I think my greatest problem will be sleeping for the week before the race. 2013 is going to be very exciting. The next one I've picked out is Graham Hewitson, and this is what Graham writes about himself. West Harlem Way Race 1, Big G, nil. Plan is to even out the score this time. Pain is temporary, failure lasts forever. Been devastated, humbled, haunted and heartbroken since my only ever DNF in the 2012 race. After a great start, the shocking weather took its toll around Ben Glass, and when I reached Auchtertier, 51 miles, I was totally confused and shivering. The mountain rescue confirmed I had hypothermia, which explained the matrix hallucinations I was experiencing. Back for more this year, armed with a better jacket and twice the desire for a goblet. I only took up running a couple of years ago to raise money for York Hill, but fell in love with trails, the great outdoors and the amazing camaraderie between ultra runners. West Harlem Way Race has a unique ability to consume all your thoughts. It's always on the mind. So looking forward to great banter and more adventure in 2013 race. My brother Jeff is leading my support crew. He finished the 2012 race and has since used his bragging rights daily. All the best, everyone. Hopefully we'll all achieve our goals and make it to Fort William and the prize giving. Next one I've picked out at random is Carol Martin. I started running off-road multi-day marathon events in 2012, and this will be my third year of competing in various Scottish ultramarathons. Last year was my first West Harlem Way race, and I can't believe I am back for more. Just hoping for better conditions this year to make the event even more enjoyable. I have met some fantastic people during the various races, training events, and looking forward to all our training runs again in 2013. The last one I've picked out is a stalwart of the West Harlem Way race, Fiona Rennie. I'm really excited about this year. This will be my 10th West Harlem Way race. I have many special memories and I plan to make loads more. This race means so much to me. It has shaped my life over the years, and I doubt I'd be the person I am today if the West Harlem Way hadn't given me the strength to face other challenges that life has thrown my way. I'm not too bothered about setting a time goal, although a PB would be a bonus. It is a privilege to have the health to run and something I'll never forget. Just as long as I can batter the leisure centre doors from their hinges within the time limit will be cause for celebration. I plan to start celebrating my good fortune with every step from Mulgai, but I'll save waving my arms in the air and squealing woohoo for when I sprint into the leisure centre's car park. If you would like to read the tales of my previous West Harlem Way adventures, you'll find them all here. Fiona Rennie, westwhw.blogspot.co.uk. So I say, just a bit of a flavour from five profiles from the race. There's lots of others. And if you've entered the race and haven't sent me your profile yet, then if you could send it to me, that would be great. And it'd be really good to have as many as we can, because it does give everyone a sense of getting a feel of who else is in the race. And I think really helps with the whole feeling of this great family race that we are trying to encourage people to be part of. For my blog post of the week, I'm going to take a post from Jez Bragg. Jez Bragg was a former West Harlem Way record holder until last year when Terry Conway beat his record. And Jez has gone on to run lots of different races and does a lot with North Face as well. And at the moment, I know a number of us are following his journey across New Zealand. He set off on about the 5th of December, and is basically running from the very north of the island, of the North Island, to the very south of the South Island. There's a new footpath which is 1,863 miles long, called the Te Araroa, I think that's how you pronounce it, the long pathway. And basically Jez is running round about sort of 30 to 40 miles per day for about 50 days. And at the moment, I've got his blog site up at the moment, and this is on Thursday the 10th of January. And basically he's got two people who back him up. At the end of each day he puts a little report, or one of his support do, about how he's got on that day. And this one was quite interesting because it was actually 3 days, days 28 to 30, a traverse of the Richmond range. And he was actually 3 days with a small backpack and crossing this ridge. And so I thought I'd read that out, give you a bit of a flavour of what Jez is doing in New Zealand. It's really interesting. He's obviously running really strongly. So it might give you a taste of it. And if you haven't had a look, then please do. Jez's blog site is jezbragg.blogspot.co.uk. So here we have Thursday, 10th of January, 2013, days 28 to 30, a traverse of the Richmond Range. And the cumulative distance that he's up to so far is 1,920 kilometres. And not sure what it is in overall, over 3,000 kilometres. So he's well over halfway, about two-thirds of the way in now. So here we are. I'm just in from a 3-day north to south fast pack across the Richmond Range. If that had to be a standalone adventure trip, I would feel very satisfied. But to think it came just a couple of days after the Cook Strait and the Queen Charlotte track is pretty mind-blowing. Anyway, I need to look forwards, not backwards. There is something rather refreshing about tortoising like this, having everything you need on your back. But it's obviously considerably slower than just having a day pack set up. In contrast to Queen Charlotte track, the range offers ultimate solitude and some seriously challenging terrain, which dictates a slow and steady pace you could be otherwise you'd be unwise to force. I couldn't have run it any faster if I tried. The only way to crank up the distance is to be out there longer, and that I did, running 3 times 14-hour days. Now I'm tired. The trick I find is to not skimp on food. To keep moving for that length of time for 3 consecutive days requires a lot of energy. So I carried generous quantities of food and stopped regularly to have hot meals, well, freeze-dried meals for 2. They are pretty good actually, although now I've worked my way through the full menu selection, I'm getting a little more choosy about flavours. I was fortunate to have James and Mark offer to walk in to meet me around halfway and provide me with a resupply of food. It's amazing what a fresh batch of cheese sandwiches does for morale. Anyway, that's enough about food. The terrain was incredibly diverse and intensely challenging. The route started on riverside trails, which, I've learned from experience, are the slowest going of all on the Te Aroha. But I enjoy taking in the different type of forest the South Island offers, drier underfoot and less dense, as well as the unreal-looking turquoise-coloured water to the rivers. On a long journey like this, it's easy to find the best bits of the countryside, and to have it all to myself is quite a treat. If only I had a little more time to enjoy it. My choice, I know. By the end of day one, I was up high and above the tree line, and started the alpine route properly on day two. It reminded me of a big day out in the Scottish Highlands, with rock, scree and limited vegetation. The route is marked up high using poles, which are great in good visibility, but today, for instance, when it was cloudy, foggy and raining all day, navigation can be quite a challenge. My Garmin Oregon GPS unit is undoubtedly the most important piece of kit and has saved my bacon on more than one occasion. I spent the majority of day two up high, which included a trip up Mount Rintoul at 1,731 metres. I craved to say hi the whole time, but what goes up? And finally, today was a complete washout. It rained from the moment I left the hut to about 5 p.m. Staying warm and in good spirits was quite a challenge, but a hot lunch, there we go, food again, seemed to sort me out and get me through to the moment the sun finally came out. So I visited all the huts on the route, 9 in total, so I can tell you which are the nice ones, which are the old ones, and the one with the resident mouse. They really do provide an incredible facility for walkers. They are typically located high up in a clearing or a place with a good view, and provide such a haven after a long day out on the trail, particularly in bad weather. Generally, they come equipped with a wood-burning stove, stored water or a stream close by, bunk beds with mattresses, space to cook, and a long drop toilet about 30 metres away. Even more impressive is just how well maintained and cared for they are. Well done, walkers. Tonight, I'm back in the van, a nice change to get my kit sorted out before I hit the fast pack section. 113 kilometres through Nelson Lakes National Park, starting first thing in the morning. The guidebook assures me it's more mellow and sociable than Richmond. I can only sincerely hope that's the case. So well done to Jez so far, and as I say, if you want to follow the rest of his journey as he runs down the South Island, then do go to his blog site, jezbragg.blogspot.co.uk. Well, I thought this year for our West Highland Way podcast, we'd follow one or two people who've not done the race before. And David McClaw very kindly offered to be a guinea pig for this and to just to follow his progress over the next 6 months of the race. So thanks very much for doing this, David. And first of all, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background to running, why you got into running in particular.
Well, the background won't take me long. I was a professional golfer, I still am a professional golfer. Rather than making my living from playing now, I've moved over to coaching. So in about 2010, rather than that spending the day hitting lots of golf balls, I needed something else to fill all that time, and what better than doing long runs. So I have done one marathon. I did the Edinburgh Marathon for charity in 2009. I finished in 3 hours 45, which I think, like everybody, the last 6 miles I ended up walking because I started off far too fast. But after I finished that, I decided that I would never do anything as silly as that again. And then, before you know it, I felt like I needed a new challenge in my life. And I'm always a fan of having setting big challenges, big goals, and what bigger goal than the West Highland Way race. So when I made that decision I wanted to do it, I thought it would take me at least 2, maybe even 3 years before I could even contemplate entering it. So I decided to enter a few of the smaller ultras and build it up that way. So at the moment I have done 4 ultras, three that were counted as finishes. One, the very first one I did, I turned up on the wrong day. I turned up a day late, believe it or not. So I ran that one myself, which was pretty funny, but I got there in the end. But ever since I completed that first ultra in 2011, I really kind of got into it and really enjoyed it.
So have you got friends who've done the West Highland Way race, or why in particular did you want to enter this race?
Well, I've touched on it in my West Highland Way profile that I read one of Dean Karnazes' really good books, and I followed his book and the idea of running 100 miles and how crazy that idea sounded. And then just having a look online, then I found, although the West Highland Way is not 100 miles, I think 95 miles is close enough. Mm. So I thought that was a really good challenge and something that I can't wait to try.
Great, well done. So the race is probably just over now, 5 months away. And I'm sure, like lots of us who are doing this race, have got a rough training plan in mind and a rough idea of what we want to do. And I'm sure you've listened to podcasts and you've talked to people, and there's a whole variety of ways to train for this race, from the mega miles to the more shorter distances and whatever. So what are some of the main things that you want to be doing over the next 5 months as you prepare for the race, in the sense of your training?
The biggest thing for me, John, is to make sure I'm on that start line. And I think if I tried to go for high mileage training plan, then I don't think I would make it. I think currently I try and stick to 4 runs a week, make sure I do one long run. So I would class a long run of anything longer than say 15 miles. I do one tempo run and a couple of easier runs, or one of those might be a hillier run. I do a little bit of cross training, a cycle doing from work, and lucky to be in the position at work at a gym, so managed to get in there and get a swim bike for an hour or things like that. But go with the premise of make sure I get those four runs in a week, and then my plan is just to build up the long runs week by week. But so much information out there that the more you read, you end up getting a little bit confused. I'm sure others are in the same position. That I think the more you do and experience, you learn what your body needs rather than what other people do. And certainly for me, I think if I had a lot of mileage, I would end up with a lot more kind of niggly injuries and stuff like that. So I'm quite happy with the 4 runs a week and then a lot of cross training in between.
Yeah. And have you got any other races planned before the West Highland Way race?
Yeah, I'm going to try the D33 one in March. There's a couple of guys that are going up that I know, so I said I'd go up. And I'm also doing the Highland Fling again, which I did last year, and I really, really enjoyed that. Because I work at weekends, I don't get to go out very often with other people. Wednesday being my day off, I tend to do my long runs on a Wednesday, so I do them all myself. And when you get to some of the races and stuff, the sense of being with other people and sharing the experience with other people is, it made a big difference and get me to the finish line.
Yeah, excellent. And as I say, the race is quite a few months away now, but what sort of goals have you got for the race? Have you got a time in mind, or what sort of particular things are you thinking at this stage?
I think all first-timers, just getting to the finish would be a great achievement. Deep down, I'd like to do it in under 24 hours. But I think because the longest ultra I've done is 53 miles, the fling, I did that in 10 hours 53, and I think it was yourself or someone had mentioned that if you double your time for the fling, you won't be too far away. So based on that, I think if I can do it in under 24 hours, then I'd be delighted with that. I don't plan on this being the only time that I do it. I would plan on and hoping to improve that time in years to go, but certainly as a starting point, if I can do it in under 24, I'll be more than happy.
Yeah, it'll be interesting as we do these over the next few months whether that changes a bit as you do your longer runs and you get a bit more of an idea of what you feel you're capable of. And just the last question, what anything that you're concerned about with the race? Anything that sort of when you wake up in the middle of the night you think, oh no, what have I done? Or is there anything in particular that you does concern you?
There is a couple of things, and based on previous ultras, I've had a couple of problems with my quads, and I still haven't quite got to the bottom of whether it's not enough salt, whether the quads are not quite strong enough, whether I'm not doing enough hillier work. So I do wake up at strange times of the night with things like that going through my head. But again, not running for 24 hours, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to go with food. And I've done okay to get by on gels for the shorter ultras, but for 95 miles, I know I'm not going to be able to stick to gels. So over the next few months, certainly in my training, I'll start to look at trying different sorts of foods out and what to try and stuff like that. But apart from that, I think it's going to be a huge mental challenge, and I don't think you can really, you really need to do it to see how you're going to get on. I don't think there's anything you can do mentally to prepare yourself for those last 40 odd miles. I think you just got to just get there and see how you go for the first thing.
Great. Well, thank you very much. And as I say, we'll try and do this once a month or once every 6 weeks or so, and we'll follow your progress as you prepare for the race. And then once you've finished it, we'll get you back and we'll have a race report as well. So thanks very much, David, and we look forward to following your progress over these next few months.
No problem at all. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Andy Cole. John Kynaston said, would I contribute to another podcast? Not quite sure why, but those who know me will know that I'm no longer gainfully employed, so in theory I've plenty of time for this sort of stuff, so here goes. My first talk was back in the winter last year, and a lot seems to have happened since then. For starters, 119 people have run a West Highland Way race. For some, their first completion. For others, the latest of many. I've enjoyed listening to all the podcasts through the autumn, some directly about this year's race and some covering more general thoughts. Hearing what guys like Paul Giblin and Richie Cunningham up at the sharp end of the field have to say is fascinating, but as a much less accomplished runner myself, I have to remember not to get too carried away in listening to what you have to do to get your time down from 17 hours to 16. What we have to understand though is that as well as being talented runners, these guys put in a huge amount of work to get to the start line in a fit enough state to achieve these sort of times. Last year's winner was Terry Conway, and if you dip into his blog from time to time, you discover that when he talks of going out for a nice run, he's as likely to mean 50 miles as 15. And if you listen carefully to the interviews with Paul and Richie, you can't miss the 100-mile weeks and then, of course, the rather throwaway line, something like, well, I try to do some hills, around 10,000 feet a week or so. Now, I did 10,000 feet a week for a couple of months during the last summer, and the only way I could manage it was to cut my overall mileage down by quite a lot because I was so slow on the hills. Try it yourself sometime and you'll see what I mean. The way these guys clock up the miles and feet of ascent is really impressive. But the overall fitness level that they achieve also means that they recover quickly afterwards. They're not still feeling the effects a month later. Paul was happy enough to attempt a Bob Graham round 2 weeks after the West Highland Way race, while Terry broke both the West Highland Way and the Lakeland 100 records in a 5 week period. I was arrogant enough to suggest in my blog recently that anyone who takes more than a week or so to get back running again after an ultra probably wasn't trained sufficiently for the race in the first place. But I've regretted saying that since listening to the tales of runners who pushed themselves so hard to get to the finish, people who wanted something so much they were prepared to put up with a lot of discomfort to achieve it. I found the podcasts by Ian Wallace, Caroline Gibson and others really quite moving. They were definitely in a land I don't really want to visit. Apart from the hallucinations, of course, we all get those, and they liven up the latter stages of most long races. I normally start with the stones underfoot turning into random electrical items, iPods, radios, that sort of thing. Then patches of water start to appear around the trail. But I only start turning bigger rocks and trees into people when I get really tired. But I'm digressing a bit here. Let's get back to the point. The other podcast that I really warmed to was the interview with Matt Moroz. Hope I've pronounced his name right. You can't fail but be carried away with his sheer enthusiasm for running, and the West Highland Way in particular. So if you haven't listened to any of these recent podcasts, then you should. They're all worth it. I can remember the exact spot where the tone for my own race last June was set. Those of you who were there will remember that conditions were a bit damp. I'd run the first 10 miles, splashing through the puddles and trying to ignore the rain. And then we came to a flat stretch of road on the top of the hill just before Drimmen. Except it wasn't a road. It was 2 or 3 inches deep in water the whole width and for a few hundred yards long. Ah, well, so that's how it's going to be, I thought, and any thoughts of a personal best time disappeared at that point. I know I can finish this race. So it was then just a question of getting to the end in as comfortable a way as possible. Damage limitation, if you like. In conditions like these, you're always wet, no matter how good you think your gear is. The only choice is between cold and wet and warm and wet. I chose the latter, stuck a light fleece on under the jacket, and put up with the odd sweaty uphill. For my money, there's absolutely no point in these conditions in wasting time changing shirts, socks or anything else, so I didn't bother. What I started with stayed on until the end. Use any stationary time drinking tea is my philosophy. Now, as those who were there will know, it rained pretty continuously for many hours. Two thoughts kept running through my head. Firstly, it surely couldn't get as bad as the previous year's UTMB, when several hours of torrential rain were followed by a rapid drop in temperature, turning everything into snow. And no, it didn't get quite that bad. Secondly, I thought of Debbie Martin-Consani in last year's Grand Union Canal race, which also had rain from start to finish. In the middle of the night, she tripped and fell in the canal, climbed out, and, reasoning that she was probably no wetter than before she fell in, she carried on to an outright victory in the race. Now, with that sort of example, you can't just wimp out because of a spot or two of rain. Actually, for those of us who took quite a while over the affair last year, things did look up a bit towards the end, and especially so for me. At Kinlochleven, it stopped raining. I'd been running on my own in the rain for some time, so this was a definite improvement. Then my daughter Julia, one half of my support team, announced that she would accompany me from there to the finish. Someone in another podcast has already said that this last 13-mile stretch represents a full day out in the hills for many people. Julia agreed. "It's bizarre," she said. "This would normally be a good day's walk for me, with maps, rucksacks and stops for sandwiches. Here I just grab one of your old waterproofs from the back of the car and set off into the gloom at 9 o'clock at night without a thought." The finish for me brought the good, the bad and the not quite sure. The good was another sparkly goblet, my sixth, enough for a small dinner party now. The bad was a mediocre time, 3 hours off my best, just scraping into the top half of the finishers. The not quite sure was learning that I'd won a prize for being the oldest finisher. A nice piece of glassware, you see, but not really the sort of image this barely middle-aged, finely honed athlete wants to promote. Now, I see a lot of runners in the vintage class on the start line this year, so come on, guys. If you were born before the 6th of August 1948, all you have to do is to get to Fort William before Sunday lunchtime. Please. But I didn't intend to spend all my time rambling on about last year's race. I'll try to use the rest of this podcast on something I hope might be useful. I've run quite a few ultras now, and one of the things I've noticed is just how many runners there are whose finish has been prevented, or whose performance severely compromised, or maybe just whose enjoyment has been badly spoiled by trouble with their feet. I've seen runners limping, hobbling, wincing. I've seen huge blisters, scarred skin, and really impressive tape jobs. Sore toes, bruised heels and twisted ankles, and all of these are things we really want to avoid. Our feet, and that includes our shoes and socks, are probably the most important bit of kit we have in long distance events, so how can we get the best out of them? I'll try to find a way through this subject, but before I start, readers of my blog will know that I always begin anything I say with a health warning. Now, I have no medical or sports science knowledge whatsoever. I'm just a middle to back of pack runner who's run a few races and an engineer who is curious about why things go wrong and how we can learn from our mistakes. So let's start with shoes. One of the standard quickfire questions at the end of these podcasts, which are in interview form, is, do you wear road shoes or trail shoes? Similarly, a common question I see asked in many forums and Facebook groups is, what kind of shoes do you think are best? Well, if you ask a question, you usually get answers. Some people will tell you that road shoes will take you anywhere. I used to be one of them. Some will say minimal is the way to go. Give your feet a real feel of the ground. Some will go to the other extreme and tell you the only way is Hokas. Some will recommend particular brands. Innovate, Brooks, Montrail, too many to mention. while others will go even further and point you towards individual models. And of course, the people that give you all these answers know they're right. And maybe they are, for them, but maybe not for you. In my opinion, and remember, this is only my opinion, the right shoes for any individual runner need to meet three main criteria. First, and I think more important than anything else, they need to fit your feet. When I bought my first pair of ski boots, after renting and borrowing for some years, I had pretty firm ideas about what I wanted. I went along to Ellis Brigham's in Manchester and was served by a wise man who'd skied for many years. He listened, but he then brought me boot after boot to try on and asked me to describe exactly how they felt before bringing me the next one. "It doesn't matter what the reviews say," he said. "If they don't fit your foot, all you're buying is pain. When you get the right pair, you'll know." After a couple of hours with boots and boxes littered all over the floor, I did get the right pair. I knew it from the moment I put them on. And they saw me through 10 years of all kinds of skiing in all kinds of territory without a moment's discomfort. Now, I should have remembered this episode when I started running ultras. It would have saved me from a lot of uncomfortable miles. Running shoes are a bit more forgiving than ski boots, but the principle is the same. If the design doesn't suit your particular foot shape, then sooner or later, they're going to hurt. So when you're thinking of choosing a new shoe, go along to the shop with the socks you're going to wear for the events you have in mind. We'll come to that bit a bit later on. And try on as many brands as you can, then only work with the ones that feel right. You'll find out which these are pretty well straight after you put them on. I was quite frustrated when Hokas first came out. I tried the Mafates and I could tell they were great shoes, but they just didn't fit my foot perfectly. I put up with some disadvantages to get the benefits, but I knew deep down they weren't right. Then Hoka brought out the Evos, which are slightly different and much better for my foot shape. I bought a pair, took them out of the box, and without any pre-testing ran the 53-mile Highland Fling. No problem. When shoes fit, you know. The second important consideration for me is how you run, or more precisely, which part of your foot you land on when you run. Now, I have a little confession to make here. I was once a runner. Back in my late teens, I could make a good enough shy at a 50-second quarter mile or a 2-minute half. Note the distances. This was way before athletics in the UK went metric. I mention this only because these sorts of distances encourage, or used to, I may be out of touch, a long stride length. And this long stride stayed with me, even though I gave up running in favour of other sports for many years, for most of my life. A long stride encouraged you to land on your heels, which for some years, after I took up running again in my mid-50s, didn't seem to me to be any problem at all. On the contrary, I had the smug feeling that I had a nice smooth running style, much better than some of the guys pattering along beside me in marathons, making lots of noise as they slapped their forefoot down on every step. And of course, the big players in the sports shoe industry were, and still are, happy to allow the heel strikers amongst us to pursue their style in great comfort by providing shoes with heavily cushioned heels. When you look at how these shoes are made, you can see that the cushioning positions your heel much higher above the ground than your forefoot sole, up to 10 millimetres or so in some shoes. This distance is called the heel lift, or some other similar term, but you should be able to discover what it is for any shoes you're thinking of buying. Wearing shoes with a high heel lift becomes almost impossible to land on anything other than your heels because there's so much material under them. But hey, this doesn't matter because you're getting all that lovely cushioning to protect your feet. And for road running up to, say, marathon distance, this has worked for many, many runners, so don't knock it. The problems start when you come to ultras, and trail ultras in particular. Trail running is a sport only recently gaining mass popularity, and shoes have had to develop quite fast. Until recently, I think trail shoes were simply compromise designs between the grip and manoeuvrability of fell shoes and the comfort and stability of road trainers. We'll come back to the whys and wherefores a bit further on, but for now, the important thing to understand is that to get better security on uneven ground, you have to give up some of the cushioning. Add that to the fact that ultras are by definition longer than marathons, sometimes much longer, and you start to understand that for runners who land on their heels, ultras have big potential to hurt your feet. Early in my ultra career, I felt that I should get some trail shoes because that's what everybody else seemed to be wearing. I followed some random forum advice and bought some Montrail Hard Rocks. I did a 5 mile familiarisation run in them, then I went out and used them on a hilly and rocky 55 mile outing. When I finished, my heels were simply wrecked. It precipitated the first bout of a condition that was to plague me over the next 3 or 4 years, plantar fasciitis. If you've ever had this, you'll understand. If you've never experienced it, then you don't want to. Your heels get so sore that even walking is painful. I never wore the Hard Rocks again. So, if your running style is that you land on your heels, you have only three options. One, stick to short races. Two, wear cushioned shoes. Or three, learn to land on your forefoot. Now, if you've been running a while and have a natural or acquired style for some years, this third option isn't going to be easy. When the forefoot running style started to become accepted as probably the best way to go, after the book Born to Run hit the headlines a few years ago, I understood the mechanics and I bought into it. But no matter how hard I tried, I found the style unnatural and uncomfortable, and I couldn't make it work for me, so I went back to my old ways. But things move on, people get new insights, and I later found a couple of significant influences on my running style. First, I played with Hokas. The attraction was the cushioning that they give, but they also have a very low heel lift, around 4 millimetres. This is a bit tiring on your Achilles and calf muscles to start with, but it also encourages you to shift your landing point a bit further forward. Secondly, I saw an interesting short video made by Mark Lathwaite. Now, Mark is the race director of the Lakeland 100 series, and he also runs a sports shop and clinic in St Helens, and he freely shares what I think are some pretty logical ideas. I'm sure you'll find the video if you poke around a bit on the Lakeland 100 site, but it shows Mark running on a treadmill at a steady 15 kilometres an hour. To start with, he runs at 164 strides a minute, and in slow motion you see that his footfall is clearly on the heel. Then he goes up to 180 strides a minute but changes nothing else. The treadmill speed stays exactly the same, but the footfall then clearly moves to the forefoot. It's only about stride length. So I gave up trying to lean forward more to land the foot under the body and all that sort of stuff, and thought only about taking shorter, quicker strides. A dodge that worked for me was breathing. Over the years, I've learned that on fairly even ground at a comfortable pace, I normally breathe once every 5 strides. So I tried switching to a breath every 6 strides. This increased the cadence, my stride length naturally decreased, and I started landing on the forefoot. It was as easy as that. I sometimes drift back into my old ways when I get a bit tired, but a bit of concentration pulls me back in line. Try it as an experiment sometime. The ability to land on your forefoot, either all the time or when you choose, hugely increases the range of shoes you can wear comfortably for an ultra distance, and that in turn increases your options for looking after your feet. I think I have to include here a word or two about gait. My understanding is that this is not so much about how your foot lands, but how it moves through its time in contact with the ground. Generally, we land with our weight towards the outside of our foot. Then, as we move forward over it, the weight transfers inwards, so that as we push off again, the weight is nearer to the centre or even the inside of our forefoot. This weight movement is called pronation. Some of us run correctly. Some transfer the weight too far during the foot contact, and that's called overpronation, and some not far enough, underpronation. Under or overpronation may cause you problems in areas other than your feet, but if you're loading your feet incorrectly, my reasoning is that it must affect them as well to some extent, and looking after your feet is what this little ramble is all about. If you think you've got a problem, or don't know, you can have your gait analysed. Some specialist running shops do this, or you can go to a podiatrist who is a runner, and the latter point is really important. I've done both, and I've found the latter to be more helpful, but that's not to say that good running shops don't do a good job. Some shoe companies make shoes designed to to correct pronation, which they do by slightly changing the plan shape of the shoe. They work fine for some people, but they're not tailored to the individual foot. For that, you have to go to a podiatrist who will design and make, or have made, custom insoles to correct your individual problem. When I did that, the guy that I went to offered me the choice of some high-tech computer-profiled insoles for about £100 a pair, or what he called the Blue Peter option, where he stuck bits of hard foam onto a standard insole for £25. The Blue Peters sorted me out and have lasted for years, but his skill was clearly in knowing which bits to stick on and where. The third consideration when choosing shoes is what event they are for and how you're going to approach it, because ultras are not all the same and neither are the ways that different runners will tackle them, so the best shoes for the day will also vary. I said earlier that I thought that trail shoes were a compromise design between fell and road shoes. Well, they may have started that way, but it's a bit more complicated now. Studs cope well with steep grass and muddy tracks, not so good if you've got lots of smooth hard trails and road. After 12 hours or so of pounding rocky trails, feet tend to get bruised, and manufacturers have devised two ways of dealing with this. Some shoes have a hard plastic sole plate between the inner and outer soles under the forefoot, while the strange-looking Hokas have gone the other way with an outrageous amount of cushioning. It's worth dwelling a while on Hokas. They seem to provoke very strong reactions among the running community, both positive and negative. When I first saw them a couple of years ago, I thought they must be worth a try, because before I managed to get into some effective forefoot running, I used to get sore feet in the latter stages of long ultras, whatever I wore. So I bought a pair of Hoka Mafatis, and for the first 3 or 4 weeks I was really disappointed. The fit wasn't great for me, so they weren't very comfortable. They didn't have much grip in many conditions, they had no precision over boulders, and I always came back with tired legs. I nearly threw them away, but two things encouraged me to persist. Firstly, I understood that the designers were a couple of ex-Salomon guys. Now, the Salomon company has been behind a huge number of game-changing designs in skiing, climbing and running, so the designers must in general be good. Maybe they just had something that I wasn't seeing. And secondly, there were the downhills. The Hoka strapline is time to fly, and if you want to experience this, you just have to get yourself to the top of a stony but not too technical downhill and try to forget all your preconceived ideas about how to run down it. Imagine that it's an easy-angled, dry grass field. Don't worry about the individual footfalls and just go. The effect really is amazing. I can only describe it as the difference between downhills on a mountain bike with and without suspension, or cruising through off-piste crud on modern wide skis compared with the long, narrow planks we used a generation ago. A trial becomes a pure pleasure. I thought about all the batterings my feet had taken along the Larrig Moor, down the Garbin Road, and down the long hills on the Cleveland Way. I needn't ever go through that again. I gradually got used to the Hokas when I started running more on my forefoot, and I got a better fit by moving from the Mafatis to the Evos, as I explained earlier. So they are definitely an interesting new option. But no... So out of all this collection of information, how do I go about choosing shoes? Well, after a lot of mistakes and learning, my thinking now goes something like this. Anything with significant technical ground, say Bob Graham round type territory, particularly if it's wet, I'll wear a light, low-profile shoe with some sort of stud on the sole for grip. The ones that suit my foot shape are Salomon Speedcross. Wonderful grip and agility, but seriously light, almost like a minimal shoe. So for easier but still rocky trails where I want to push along at a good speed, but need a bit more protection against the bruising, I'll take a simple all-round trail shoe. Mine are Asics Trabucos. They're manoeuvrable, have a good grip on the rocks, and I know I have an Asics-shaped foot, having run in Asics road shoes for years. But for anything where I'm going to be on my feet for a long time, I go with the Hokas. The long-range comfort is just too good to give up, but I accept there will be compromises. For example, on the West Highland Way, I have to accept that I will be slow and careful coming down Connick Hill and going along the lock north of Inversnaid. But this is a price worth paying for the comfort from Tyndrum to the finish. A faster and better trained runner than me might make a different choice, of course, going for more agility on the rocky sections and not bothering about the need for comfort over the second half. Probably enough about shoes. You might have fallen asleep by now. Hopefully not if you're listening to this while running, although that has happened to me on one or two occasions. But if you've got shoes that fit your feet and are appropriate for the event that you're trying, you've probably done all you can to avoid skeletal and general soft tissue injury to your feet. So all you have to do now is look after the skin. Last September I did the Tour de Géant event in northern Italy, which is run on a course 200 miles long and with a total ascent of around 80,000 feet. About every 35 miles there's a major checkpoint called a life base, and at each one of these I saw people retiring from the race. In spite of monumental work by a very professional and enthusiastic team of doctors and paramedics, whose view in general was, if you think you're okay to carry on, we're here to help, not stop you, the major cause of people dropping out by a long, long way was blisters. They simply couldn't stand the pain of standing up any longer. And this was in a race where for most of the time everyone had dry feet. Throw in a bit of the dampness normal in most British ultras and blisters can become a showstopper far too often. As I said earlier, I'm not a medic, but it seems pretty clear that blisters come from friction. And you get that when the fabric of your sock rubs against the skin of your foot or toes. Try a little experiment. Put a couple of fingers inside a sock and rub it on the back of your hand for a minute or two. Your hand will soon begin to feel warm and a bit sore. The harder you press while rubbing, the worse it feels. Now thoroughly wet the bit of sock you're using and repeat the process. Yep, it's much worse. Now imagine that continuing for 12, 15, 24 hours. Exactly. Now, for the technically interested, all this has demonstrated is what an engineer would tell you anyway about this frictional force and the degree of damage that it's likely to do. It's dependent on two factors. Firstly, the pressure between the rubbing surfaces, more pressure, more force. And secondly, the coefficient of friction between the two surfaces. If they slide easily, there's less force, and if they are stickier, there's more. So to stop blisters, all you have to do is to remove or at least minimise this frictional force. I can't give you a magic answer because everyone's different, but what I can do is try to explain my view of how things work so you can try some things out. The first thing to do is to minimise the pressure. You can't get away from the force that causes this pressure. It's the only way that energy can be transmitted from your legs to the trail via your socks and shoes. But what you can do is to make sure that it's evenly spread. That means shoes which fit properly, which, if you've been with me since the start of this talk, you already know is the most important decision you can make, and here it is again. Any pinch points will concentrate pressure in that area and remove it from others, and that's the quickest way to a blister. Now, what about the rubbing? The best thing you can do to start with is to prevent or minimise any movement between your sock and the skin. The most obvious thing to do is to tape your feet. The tape sticks to your skin without moving, so any friction is between tape and sock, not sock and skin, so no blisters. There are downsides though. Tape doesn't deal very well with the multi-curvature of our feet, and ruckled up tape can be worse than none at all. Tape can start to misbehave if it gets wet, and the best tape for staying stuck isn't necessarily the most flexible. You have to experiment. It's not a thing to try out for the first time in a race, but it's still a pretty useful technique in its proper place. I have quite prominent heel bones. No way I can take the pressure point away, so I tape them with short lengths of ordinary white 5cm wide surgical tape, and it works for me. Another way of isolating shoe movement from feet is to wear two pairs of socks. The theory is that the thin inner pair clings to your foot, while the thicker outer pair moves with the shoe. I've used this method with a thin wicking pair inside a thicker cotton pair, both bought for next to nothing at Marks & Spencer's, and the system saw me through 5.5 days of pretty continuous movement in the Tour de Géant with no blisters or soreness at all. The only drawback is that it's not so effective when your feet get really wet, when both pairs of socks tend to cling together into one squidgy mass. But if none of this works, or sort of works, but not completely, and you're still left with movement between sock and skin, what next? Some sort of lubrication between sock and foot. Cutting down the coefficient of friction, remember, is the next step. For years, I used good old Vaseline, which is okay, but doesn't last long, and you need to reapply. Not the sort of thing you want to be doing every 20 miles in a long outing. Plenty of expensive proprietary products are around, but I eventually settled on Sudocrem, a product designed for preventing nappy rash, as working best for me. A good smear all over foot and toes before you put your sock on seems to work for at least 24 hours and goes a long way to preventing friction damage. The main disadvantage is the messy white marks it leaves on your carpet, car seats, or anything else you're unlucky enough to touch before you get your socks on. Then there are various sorts of magic socks, all claiming to be the best answer for long distance running. They all have their fans, but I suspect none has the complete answer, although they all offer something. I've never got around to trying Injinges, which have individual toe pockets, because I've never really seen why you would need this, but they have their followers. I've worn seal skins for several wet races with some success. These have a thin Gore-Tex layer sandwiched between a fine woven inner and a coarser outer, and are supposed to be waterproof. Well, they are, I suppose, in the same way that Gore-Tex jacket is waterproof when you're running in very wet weather. That is, you get just as wet on the inside as you do on the outside. But in seal skins, at least your feet stay warm and wet rather than cold and wet, which is sometimes a feeling worth having. Knowing that they are going to get wet inside, though, is the key. It makes it even more important to put on a good layer of waterproofing grease like Sudocrem, or you end up with a lot of shriveled skin. My main gripe with seal skins, though, is that they're expensive and the Gore-Tex layer is pretty flimsy, so holes soon start to appear in it, often after only one race. I recently started trying out Drymax Ultra Socks. These are nice socks, so they're very comfortable, but the main claims are, firstly, that they draw moisture away from your skin more effectively than other socks, and secondly, that they contain Teflon to reduce friction in any rubbing you do get. The leap of faith that those of us used to other socks have to make is to use no lubrication at all, as it can compromise their effectiveness. After a few trial runs, I used a pair in last December's Tour de Helvellyn, where my feet were completely soaked for 9 hours, with no foot problems at all. The fibres look a bit ragged now, so I'm not quite sure how they'll fare in a longer event, or what their overall lifetime is, but they look quite promising. That's it then. My views. Others may disagree with them, but it's what I think I've learned over the course of around 36 or so ultras in the last few years. No magic answers, no solution that will work for everyone, just a couple of simple rules. Get shoes that fit and are right for the job you want to do. Inside them, stop as much movement between your sock and your foot as you can and help what's left to slide easier. And that looks after your feet. Simple. So, if you're on the start list for this year's West Highland Way, I hope your training goes well and see you in Nolgai.
So, thanks for listening for the latest podcast, number 30. And watch out in a few weeks' time. We've got the training weekend coming up in a week and a half's time. So I'm hoping to interview Ian Beattie, the race director, then. And then we'll have some other items as well. So watch out for the next one, hopefully coming out in a couple of weeks' time. So remember, slow and steady wins the race.